This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, the soon-to-be-retired host of this show, and I'm spending my last few days in this role listening back to some of my more memorable programs from the past 15 years. So let's go back to a conversation with Josh Lozoff. When the Chapel Hill native was 19, he moved to Los Angeles to be an actor, and the move paid off. He played a recurring role on the sitcom Cheers. He was part of the ensemble cast in the hit movie Clueless and was also on the cult favorite nighttime sitcom Sisters. But after the Northridge earthquake in 1994, Josh felt the need to devote himself to public service. He volunteered with the Red Cross emergency crew, traveled through Latin America, and eventually returned to North Carolina, and that is when he fell in love with magic. He created a close-up magic show that had become wildly popular when I spoke with him back in 2007. This is one of the conversations that stands out in my mind because, on the one hand, it is a profile of a man with a fascinating life story, actor turned volunteer turned magician, but it was more. It was also a close look at the nature of human perception and attention. Oh yeah, and he read minds over the radio. We put out a request for calls during the show, but obviously this is a recorded program, so please don't call in. I began our conversation by asking Josh to describe his particular form of magic.
Well, I wouldn't deny that most of what I do is illusion, but when I started doing magic, I had much of a clearer kind of black and white delineation between tricks and magic. And when people say, is it real or is it just a trick, I understood that difference. But the longer I do it, I feel like there's a big gray area where I don't feel like anything I do is just a trick, but it certainly requires skill. It's not that I have, you know, magic potions or say spells. I mean, but to me, that's the same as a lot of other arts where there's something magical about somebody who, or not even just the arts, but if you see Michael Jordan with a basketball or Tiger Woods playing golf, there's something that's more than just the result of the time put into it. There's something magical about seeing somebody really really connected to their craft, but it is the result, the consequence of a tremendous amount of work and technique and skill, and certainly I do that as well.
There's a lot of technique involved, a lot of skill, and then a lot obviously has to do with the audience, and the world could easily divide between those who love magic and those who absolutely hate it, and I'm sure you've confronted all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk with people. What is it about people? Let's start with the people who say they hate magic. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's different reasons for it. But what I found is a lot of people don't like to be fooled, and I don't like to be fooled. I mean, I think fooling is generally a negative term, even though we use it in magic as kind of the goal, or some people use it in magic as the goal. And I think it's understandable because in general, being fooled means being tricked, and the person who is fooling you kind of wins and you lose. So when I kind of share magic with people and I just get an instinctive sense that there's kind of a little bit of antagonistic energy, it's usually because their assumption is that magic is about a win or lose thing. If they catch me, they win and I lose.
Right.
And if I fool them, I win and they lose. And I'm not really interested in winning or losing, and I'm not interested in them, certainly in making anyone else feel like they've lost. So my goal is to kind of change the vibe and make it feel more just like entertainment, something that we're sharing and enjoying all together.
And you do what might be described as table magic. You're not necessarily on a big stage in front of a large audience. And how is that different in kind? Is it different in training and different in kind than the large performance?
Well, there's different skills involved in the sleight, and mostly, you know, the sleight of hand goes along with the table magic, and that's certainly how I started, although there's some non-sleight of hand things that I do at this point that are the most exciting. But yeah, there's in the different genres in the magic world are kind of broken down into close-up magic, parlor-sized stage magic, which I've just gotten into recently, and then the kind of the large illusions. Mostly in the magic scene, illusionists are the people who are, you know, cutting people in half and levitating people and making a car appear on stage. And although, you know,
and you need an attractive assistant for that.
Yeah, you got to have somebody. You got to have an attractive assistant.
That whole thing.
Yeah.
So can you do, let's do a trick on the radio, which is a trick all by itself. The fact that we're even going to attempt this to give us a sense of Josh Lozoff magic.
Right. Now, you know, obviously magic is mostly a visual art. So I'm going to kind of depend on you clarifying for the audience what's happening so everyone can visualize this. But I've set a deck of cards on the table from before we began the show, and you can verify that.
I can verify that there's a box, bicycle box, and
that's
assuming that inside there is a deck of cards. Could be anything, Josh.
All right, that's true. You're going to be a sharp one, Frank.
Yeah.
I might not get away with this.
I am pretty darn clever.
Okay. I did something to the deck. There's something arranged about it. There's one card reversed in the deck just so I'm kind of committed to a decision that I made before we began. Right. And just so it's clear, it's not sleight of hand. I love sleight of hand. I practice it. I'm good at it, but I can't really do it over the radio. So what I'd like for you to do in just a second is I'm going to have you think of a card, and truly it can be one of any of the 52. Mm-hmm. But before you do, I'm going to ask you two questions which you can answer in your mind, and I'll do it quick just so that we can keep this mm-hmm. as entertaining as possible. But mm-hmm. would you think of a person very dear to you right now?
Okay.
And think of the thing you'd most like to be doing right now. And you'll keep it to yourself so you can be honest.
I certainly will.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Now, without thinking about it too much, keep eye contact with me and just say the name of a card. Any card you want, you come up with it.
Okay. Ace of Spades.
Ace of Spades. Okay. Here's the interesting thing. And you can see this deck is here, and you can kind of, would you describe maybe what I'm doing as I do it? That I'm taking the deck
all right,
out.
You got it. Ten of Spades is on top. You're separating them out. That's
okay.
Right.
And they
appear to be, and then there's one card that's upside down. So I'm seeing the faces of all the cards as you fan them out. There's one card that is, the back is up. I can't see the face of that
certainly
card.
Certainly couldn't have been sleight of hand. I mean, you just saw me spread through the deck immediately.
I did. And there it is.
That's the Ace of Spades.
Ace of Spades.
Yeah. Decision I made based on what I thought you might choose. Well,
And we really didn't talk about that, so actually I'm sort of dazzled by that.
Yeah.
Although, you know, who knows? I mean, I picked it in a sense. I was thinking to myself, well, you know, what's the most likely Ace of Spades? That makes it the least likely.
Right.
I thought myself. So, but you did that, and I did see that right before my very eyes.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And then people do, when they sit there at the table, and I'm supposed to talk, so I have to say something. But really, I've got nothing to say. And the cool thing is, you get this most of the time.
Right. Well. And one of the things that I feel very fortunate about the people that I've learned from is they passed on to me a respect for that period of time.
Hmm.
And I've seen, and it's easy to not understand. I mean, it's very easy to be a magician and just be so in love with the technique and the practicing of the magic that we forget that the moment the magic really happens has nothing to do with what I do with my hands or even what I did here, which wasn't a sleight of hand effect. It has to do with what happens in your being after everything's over.
And so what
I try to do is I try to leave people with enough time after I do something to have that experience, because that's when the magic happens. If I rush right into another trick, I would be preventing people from having a magical experience.
When you are working with groups, even in small groups, I suspect there are people who are very skeptical, and there's a kind of an energy working against you. It's like constantly trying to find out what it is or not show you that they're dazzled. I mean, does that sort of hurt the whole? Does that make it difficult for you as a performer?
I really, at this point, love sharing magic with all different types of people. When I started, there were people who just were immediately into it and very comfortable expressing their excitement and their amazement were the most enjoyable people to share magic with, because there's a big reaction and people laugh or they scream or they, you know, drop the cards and run away and come back. But at this point, I love sharing magic with people, and I love sharing magic with all different types of people.
You were a professional actor. You were, as I say, you had a role on Cheers. So you were successful in Hollywood. Tell us about breaking in. What's that like?
Well, very difficult.
Yeah.
The quick short story of my path was that I grew up around here, and it was at the time that the Wilmington film industry was really starting to develop. So probably once a month or maybe even more frequently, my dad would drive me down to auditions in Wilmington and drive back. And then we'd get a call for a call back and we'd drive all the way. And that was before 40. So it was about 4.5 hours to get down to Wilmington. And there would be times like, you know, you'd drive all the way. The very first audition I went to was to drive all the way down to have a casting agent tell me that I didn't look like I could be Sissy Spacek's son. Which, if you are looking at me,
that would be disappointing.
You would know quite easily. I mean, you could have seen that from a picture, but they didn't. They waited till I got down there to tell me that. So I paid my dues basically, and I got my first part in a movie in 1987. Got my union card. It was a television miniseries. I did 4 things altogether in Wilmington before I moved out to LA. So I already had my union card and a nice resume for somebody, you know, at that age. And moved out to LA and spent the first year trying to get an agent, trying to, you know, calling friends of friends, and had a list of names and, you know, friends of relatives and relatives of friends, and got an agent, and then auditioned quite steadily for a year. And then the first thing I got was actually the part on Cheers, which turned into a recurring role.
Turned into a, did you have to call Rhea Perlman mom?
I called her Ma.
Ma.
Yeah. Hey, Ma.
And in real life, that would have made Danny DeVito your father.
That's true. That's true.
You don't look like either of them either, come to think of it. But you still got that role.
That's right.
When you're doing a recurring role like that, and again, we're going to, I think, talk a lot about how that compares. I mean, how does acting compare to magic in the sense, particularly in a recurring role mm-hmm. like that, where, you know, it is wildly successful, of course, but utterly formulaic,
yeah,
right?
Right. Well, especially, I mean, my recurring role was each episode felt more like a guest star shot to me because there was one in one year and then two in the next. It wasn't like I was on every other week or anything like that. But certainly, I mean, formulaic is exactly the right description for how the show felt at that point. You know, I mean, they were in their ninth season before I even stepped on the set. So everybody has everything down to rote, and there wasn't like a bunch of people sitting around saying, hey, what should we do this week to make it? I mean, there's just a
script. Was it people kind of dragging themselves to work by then?
A little bit. I mean, they're all very friendly and very nice. But yeah, there was, I mean, getting assistant director, the production assistant who had to corral the main cast was like herding cats. You know, it was like, okay, we got you know, Ted. Okay, where's Woody? Oh, wait, Woody's in his dressing room talking to his agent. Okay, Kirstie's on the set. Okay, we lost Ted. Okay, we'll get him back.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what it was like. But it was, I mean, it was a treat. I grew up watching Cheers. So for that to be my first gig out there was a huge treat.
Replaying my conversation with magician Josh Lozoff from 2007. One of the many I hoped you might like to hear again as I prepare to sign off as host of The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. More of Josh just ahead. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, remembering a conversation from 2007 with North Carolina native Josh Lozoff. He's a magician who's been studying and sharing magic around the world for decades. In the previous segment, Josh did a trick in which I picked a card, and Josh guessed correctly that it was the Ace of Spades. Now, I knew there was going to be some kind of trick. I knew that in advance, that he planned to do a trick in the first segment, but I asked the staff not to tell me what he was planning. So now, as we began the next segment, I asked him if he could do it again.
I've already set up the deck with a different card this time, so don't choose Ace of Spades, or that's the only thing we can guarantee how it will go wrong. Yeah. It's more of a long shot the second time, because you know what to expect, but we'll give it a shot. Let me put you in a different place, and we'll just do one thing this time. Imagine a place, like maybe a vacation spot that you really like to be in a lot. Picture yourself there, and we'll just do that for a couple of seconds. And again, make eye contact with me. And this time, let's do it in two steps. First, choose the suit of your card out of the four suits that cards come in. Okay? And now the value, so that now you have one card altogether, but it happened in two steps. And again, the deck is on the table from beforehand, just so people can visualize what's going on. Mm-hmm. This won't be sleight of hand. You have a specific card in mind?
Yeah.
Okay. If this doesn't work, just remember how amazing it was that it worked.
I will, and we'll talk about it the first time, because it was amazing, and we really didn't talk about it. So here we go. So okay. I have imagined this place, a favorite vacation place, picked a suit, picked a card.
Okay.
And you can
say it out loud now.
I can say it out loud. Three of hearts. Didn't do it?
That's why I love sharing magic with people. There's one single card that I have this time. One single card that I have, as you know.
Yeah. And we're fanning them out. Right? Fanning them out. There's one card. Yep.
You can all the rest are face up.
You're going to flip. That's the three of hearts, Josh. So now I have to ask you, how do you do that trick?
Well, the parts of it that I can talk about are about making a connection with people. I had a little bit of an advantage with...
That was the three of hearts.
I know. It's really crazy. I know. Believe me. I know. If we had the time to sit here and just be in silence, that's what we would want to do.
Wow.
I have the slight advantage with you of having listened to you on the radio, and although I don't know anything more about you than anyone else who listens to your show, I am working with my intuition and guiding you a little bit, of course, asking you to either think of a place or think of somebody you love or something like that, and then just making a guess. And then also using magic techniques. I mean, there's magic involved in it.
A little bit of magic, but there's a little bit of intuition. So, to some extent, I guess a magician, anybody who's going to do sleight of hand has to have that sort of intuition. Are you interacting? Are you with the audience?
Yeah, one of the great things, my favorite part, and I didn't answer it earlier when you asked me about the differences, one of my favorite parts about close-up magic is how improvisational I can be. I have specific effects that I love sharing and ways of presenting it that I love presenting it that way. But all the time, if I approach a group of four, and just to describe like what my general gig is, you know, it could be a real large event or a corporate, you know, or a cocktail reception or a corporate party or something, and there might be 500 people, but I'll be walking around the crowd, approaching three or four people at a time, socializing and share 5-10 minutes of magic. And because I'm just with three or four people, as I'm doing the magic, I'm intuitively getting a sense of what they might enjoy about magic or what kind of presentational style they might like. And, you know, when I started out with a very clear sense of what I thought magic was and how I wanted to share it. It was very rigid and fixed. And what I've how I've relaxed over the last decade is really looking for what would feel magical to the group that I'm sharing it with, making it more about them. And, you know, and I have a consistency in my style just because I'm who I am. But, you know, if I can tell that people are kind of fascinated by my technical ability with cards, I might do something a little flourishy. If people are asking me about, you know, crystals in Sedona, Arizona, I might do something that has more to do with making intuitive connections with people. So,
letting them do the magic.
Yeah.
They can just go off into their bliss and have whatever magical experience
they
want.
Yeah.
Well, is there a difference then between the kind of magician who does, you know, sort of the amazing fish who's on stage with his lovely assistant, but I'm wondering now if they can have it down. It really doesn't matter who's out there, if anybody's out there. They get out the saw, they get out the rings, they do the same thing every day.
Right.
Or does every magician, whether you're at the table or in Las Vegas, have to have that kind of intuition?
I think every good magician does. First of all, I'll say that I like the amazing fish. He's a very good magician. I think a good magician should at any level, but of course it's harder. I had this experience myself. If I'm on a stage with 80 people, there's no way, I need to have a very pat show. And just like any actor wants to be in the moment, I would love to be in the moment and make that show unique from any other night. But you can't nearly be as improvisational or as jazz-like as doing close-up magic.
So tell us how we talked about your career as an actor. You were in Cheers for a while, and then you decided to leave that profession.
Yeah, it pretty much started with the Northridge earthquake in '94. Acting had already started to be a little less and less important, but I hadn't really acknowledged it or admitted it. And I've been acting since I was 9 professionally, so it was a potentially kind of frightening life identity crisis to start acknowledging that acting wasn't kind of my total focus in my life anymore. But it started to happen, and then the earthquake happened, and I did some real intense volunteer work with the Red Cross in Santa Monica, and I really that made me really feel it. It was like using a muscle that I hadn't used in years that I suddenly realized I missed. I mean, it was just very, very direct to be providing a service, to be helping people out, to be doing something physical that I could have a immediate response to. If I, you know, make a call and get somebody housing, boom, it's done. You know, acting, you know, the arts are more kind of less tangible than that.
Sure. And was it the volunteer work itself, or was there something about the moment of that earthquake that?
It was mostly the volunteer work.
Yeah.
It was just,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I had these 18-hour days for about 3 weeks straight, and there's a group of us who all worked together, and we were exhausted, but it felt so fulfilling in a way that acting certainly can for people and had for me, but didn't on a regular basis.
And you became an EMT?
Yeah, I got my EMT. So the kind of the consequence of that was that summer I spent, I found a volunteer group to work with in Guatemala, just following a hunch or an instinct of mine, something I thought I might, you know, really enjoy and might be a worthwhile thing to do. And then that fall I took my EMT class, got certified. I never really used it until I moved back here to North Carolina, but that was kind of this beginning of realizing that there's other things that nourish me, that I could look into rather than just feeling like, if I'm going to be a professional actor, I need to, you know, just focus on that and not acknowledge other things satisfy me.
I'm wondering if the anxiety had already passed once you began volunteering or chose to become an EMT, or, you know, was there a morning you woke up and said, "My God, I'm in an ambulance. I'm not on the set anymore. who am I?"
I went to an audition. It was actually before the shelter closed, so I was still working at the Red Cross, and the audition. It was annoying to me that I had to interrupt this important thing to go to an audition.
Huh.
And that's kind of, I mean, if you're an actor and that happens, you should kind of start thinking about doing something else.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, people used to tell me, and I always kind of thought it was a little bit patronizing, but people used to say, if there's anything else you love other than acting, you should do it because it's so challenging. And I still do think that's kind of a little bit of a scare tactic, but now I see it from a different point of view, which is just that there's things that can be more fulfilling on a regular basis than pursuing a career in the arts. And if you really can't imagine doing anything else, then that's who should be pursuing those kinds of careers. And once I started to imagine other things satisfying me, it was time to kind of admit that to myself and pursue that.
You were an EMT here in Orange County.
Yep.
But then you stopped to become a magician.
I didn't stop, actually. I evolved into that. And
right.
And being an EMT was a wonderful job for starting to practice an art like magic. I had plenty of time, even on a busy day. I had plenty of time to sit at the station and mess around with a deck of cards. And so it was a great evolution into that craft.
Is there anything about EMT training that helps the budding magician?
Probably. I love people. I like caring for people. Yeah. I like entertaining people. And so each of the things I've done have something to do with, I don't choose things like that, but looking back on it, there's nothing more magical than caring for somebody and making them feel better, comforting them while we take them to the hospital.
But how did you make that transition? If you talk about the fulfillment you felt in doing work that helps people, that is right. tangibly and materially beneficial,
shallow like being a magician?
Why are you so shallow and utterly useless?
Right. all I know is that I kind of followed my instincts, and I was never raised with kind of a mentality of a career, kind of a fear, like you better lock onto a career or job security, anything like that. So throughout my life, I don't feel like I've dabbled because I've really committed to each of the things I've done, but I have, moved on to other things when it's felt right without kind of a fear of that jump or that lack of job security or benefits or any of those kinds of things. It's just never been that important. So when magic really started feeling important to me, and because I already had a background in the arts, I believe the arts are important. And so I think that it potentially can be just as much of a service to the community to be a good artist as it is to be a medical provider. And so that just really felt like the right thing. And the other thing about being an EMT, not to get to explain it too much, but an EMT basic, which is what I was, is a wonderful first step. But it's for people who are, who are going to move on to be a paramedic or a nurse, or they're getting that training because it's great for their application to medical school. Okay. And because I was never really felt called to be a paramedic, I was an EMT for 6 years as an EMT basic, and I was, great experience, and Orange County is a great system to work in, but I would have needed to move on in that to continue feeling satisfied that I was, really helping out people.
But interesting arc, though, because you talked about not feeling too fulfilled as an actor and saying, well, why aren't I helping something? And then you say, well, yes, but the arts can be helpful, but it's here in magic. So there was a kind of a turn in your mind about which kind of performing art can be.
Well, acting could have been. I don't want to paint it as though I walked away from a successful career as an actor. Acting could have been that, and it is for a lot of people. I was making a living at it. But I was still at the point where I was really happy to get any kind of guest star shot, and I was doing episodes of, television shows, which is great. I watch TV, but I wasn't doing as an actor what I start. I started out as an actor, even from a young age, to really make a difference and do projects that, the kinds of shows or movies that, or theater that really moved me as a spectator. And I never really got the opportunity to do that.
You have a lot less control over that. Being a writer where you're stuck in your garret, but you're only going to write your novel. You have to take whatever part comes along.
Until you become at a certain level, you have no control over that at all. And I do have a lot of control over my life as a magician or over being in another career. And so that was definitely a big factor.
I think we should try another radio trick right now. We have a volunteer on the line.
Okay.
So I'm going to bring up Grace right now. Hello, Grace from Greensboro. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Because I don't know what this is yet.
No, we don't.
So the two of us are going to be surprised
here.
Okay.
Grace, hi. How's it going?
I'm doing good.
Great. You ready to try a little thing with me on the radio?
It sounds interesting.
We'll see. This is an experiment for me as well. But because I don't have, a lot of what I do has to do with reading people and getting a physical sense of what somebody's like by body positioning and how they speak to me and what they look like. And I don't have really any of that to go on with you, Grace. So I'm going to do this by your voice.
Okay.
Do you have a deck of cards?
Yes, I do.
Okay. We should have said that before a time. Is something you could grab pretty quickly?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. I'll let you go get your cards. Grace is in Greensboro. She's going to go get her cards, and we're talking with Josh Lozoff today on the state of things, a magician, a former actor, and EMT. It seems to me that in a lot of ways what you're doing as an actor and what you do as a magician are pretty similar. You've got to create an illusion. You've got to be somebody you're not when you're an actor.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's some, that I apply some of my training towards being a magician, although most of it isn't conscious. But I've always felt, and I use this example, when I come across the kind of person who's got maybe an antagonistic attitude that we spoke about earlier, I use that example of other arts like acting. If you watch a movie theater, oh, you're shuffling. That's great, Grace. I was going to ask you to do that. Good. If you watch an actor in a movie theater, nobody feels the urge to stand up and reassure the whole audience. Wait, don't be fooled by him. He hasn't really lost his daughter. He's just faking it. He's an actor. We all know we choose to go along for that experience. And in the back of our minds, we know that it's an illusion, but it's irrelevant for the moment that we want to have an emotional experience, which we made the choice to have. And I feel like magic's the same way. I don't feel like I'm not expecting people to walk out of the theater with a specific belief about my ability as a human being. The moment that I'm sharing magic with people is the moment that I want to create a magical experience and have people believe in magic, the same way you believe that something emotional is happening on a movie screen.
And you allow yourself to experience it. Well, Grace has gracefully and graciously allowed herself to be a willing participant here. Josh Lozoff, go ahead. You and
okay.
Grace.
Grace, so you shuffled the cards.
Yes, I did.
Are you right-handed?
I am.
Okay, can you put the cards face down in your left hand like you were going to deal out a game of, you know, poker or whatever?
Okay.
And one at a time, you can deal the cards face down onto the table or whatever surface is right in front of you.
Okay.
From your hand, and whenever you feel the instinct to, you can stop and tell me when you stop. And you can keep it relatively quiet so that I won't even know how many cards you've gone through.
Okay, I'm stopping.
You ready? Okay, the next card, I mean, you chose to stop where you did. The next card that you've got, turn it over face up and look at it and see what it is, but don't say it out loud.
Okay.
Okay, now turn it back face down and add it to the pile that's on the table.
Okay.
Now that's your card for the rest of this, so make sure that you remember what that one was, okay?
Got it.
Okay. And now, to reinforce its identity only for you, I want you to cover it with as many cards as the value. So if it was a four of spades, take four more cards off of the pack in your hand and put it on top of that four. If it was a king, that would be 13.
I got it.
Okay, great. Now take the whole pile that's on the table and put it back on top of the stack that's in your hand so the whole deck is back together. Okay. Now, I can only do this by your voice, and it may or may not work, but I'm going to have you read through the cards one at a time, and you can go pretty quick, but you'll say each card. You're going to turn the cards face up, put them on the table one at a time, and say what it is. And when you get to yours, try not to sound any different. And the only thing I've got to go on is maybe trying to read which card means something to you, because it's going to be your card. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
So go ahead and start with the first.
Queen Diamond.
Okay. I'm sorry. Actually, let's start back. Would you put that one back on top of the deck?
Uh-huh.
And give the deck a cut.
Okay.
A complete cut so we don't even know where in the deck the card that you're focusing on is. Okay.
All right.
And now you can go through just one at a time. And you don't have to do it too slow, but one
okay.
at a time. And when you get to your card, try not to give away anything about it.
Okay. Jack Club, Seven Heart, Nine Queen, Ace Spade, Ten Heart, Queen Diamond, Ace Heart, King Club, Three Diamond, Jack Heart, Ace Diamond, Jack Spade, four diamond, two spade, joker, five diamond, ace club, two diamond, four club, nine diamond, eight diamond, queen spade, six heart, four heart, five club, six spade, king diamond, queen club, three heart, Jack Diamond, 10 club, 7 spade, 3 spade, 9 club, 9 spade, 8 heart, King heart, 10 diamond, 10 spade, 8 spade, 7 club, 4 spade, 5 heart, King spade, 7 diamond, 9 heart, 6 diamond, 5 spade, 2 club, 2 heart.
Okay, and that was the whole deck?
Yes.
And the card that you're thinking of, the card that you chose, was one of those? You said it out loud?
Yes.
Ooh, you're good. All right, let's try this. Okay. If I heard anything at all, and I may not have because you did quite well, and be totally straight with me, even though we're kind of on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
if I heard anything at all, it was a consistency on one particular suit, so I just want to start with that. And again, be honest.
Okay.
Was your card a club?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I heard that part right. So now we'll try. Now, there are two different cards, both of them clubs, which is why I thought that I was right about that part, that I heard a slight difference on. And really, you did a great job. But if I'm right, your card wasn't on the low end of things, was it? Like under a five?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. And be totally straight with me again. If I heard it right, I believe the card that you thought of out of the whole deck was the three of clubs.
No way.
Way.
No way.
Is that it, Grace?
That's not right.
Not right as in it's not right that it happened, or not right as in I'm wrong?
No, you're right.
Oh, okay,
and it's
good.
Not right that it happened.
Yeah, that's true. It's not right. It's a little bit wrong.
Wow. That's
wow.
good.
Thanks so much for doing that with me.
Grace, you get to ask, how did you do that? You ask him this time. Because
I have no idea because I worked really hard.
And you did a great job.
Yeah.
That there was
no difference.
Inflections or difference in the way that I spoke the right card.
Wow. You did great.
Thanks a million. Thanks a million. And for playing our game, you get a book of crossword puzzles by Will Short. Sir. No, that's the other game. Okay, thanks for calling.
You get me to record home answer.
I want to be trained by Josh on how to do that. That's what I need to get. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Grace. Bye-bye. Well, we do too. Now, see, that way you couldn't even, because I got a little suspicious on the last one that maybe because I told you the card I gave you before you pulled out the cards.
Right.
If there's a way you can get to it, you could flip it before I could. But here...
No, it's over the radio.
And we really didn't work this out with Grace.
No, we didn't work out with Grace.
Are you honestly going to tell me, Josh, that you were just... that was based on your ability to kind of hear the whatever quirk in her voice?
That's part of it.
Wow. Okay, so there's another part of it.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, magic is magic. There's a lot of different aspects of it, and I was really absolutely focusing dead on what she was doing and really trying to hear a difference.
And those are some listening skills we can all use. We're replaying my conversation from 2007 with Josh Lozov, whose close-up magic show was a hit in the Triangle at the time. This memorable conversation continues in a moment. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, and today we're listening back to a conversation I had in 2007 with Josh Lozov. He became a magician after returning to North Carolina from Los Angeles, where he'd had some success as an actor. Before the break, Josh did a trick with a caller over the phone. It's one that magician David Blaine had done, and I asked Josh to tell me about that trick and David Blaine.
The quick version of that story, from what I understand, I've never met David Blaine personally, so I'll just say that, but we know some of the same people who know some of the same people. It's a small community of magicians. And from what I understand, that was one of the couple of only two or three things that he did to kind of seal his first network deal with ABC. He was in the building, but they brought him into a conference room, and they had someone stand there just so that he couldn't do anything that they wouldn't know about. And then he called the executive's office and did that particular piece of magic, and he said that he was pretty sure he got the deal when he heard all of the executives kind of open the door and run screaming out of their office.
It is the reaction, too. That's the amazing thing.
It's all about
that
the
makes this stuff good. Do you have tricks, any tricks in common?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a couple of things I do. I mean, you know, magic is, especially his first special, which was heavy on card magic and close, pretty traditional close-up magic, really. One of the things I respect most is that he took relatively traditional magic and knew that it could be very entertaining on television based on a performance style rather than feeling like he had to come up with something bigger than anyone else had ever done or anything like that. The thing that I respect most and that I really am grateful for his celebrity status is that he did exactly what we've been talking about, which, I mean, if you take a look at his first specials, there's more airtime for the faces of the people watching than there is for him. And here's somebody who's never been on television before and certainly wants to become a big star, and he made the choice that he was going to be reflected more positively and more strongly by keeping the camera on the people reacting than on keeping the camera on the magician, on the all-powerful guy doing the magic. That's not where the magic happens. And he knew that and knows that, and that's why he's so successful.
Great, great magician sometimes look at the cards in the eyes of their own other folks on the other side.
Yeah.
But no, that's a very good point. And you make that point another way when you talk about what we really mean when we ask you, how did you do that?
Right, yeah. You know, of course, it's a very natural question. It doesn't bother me in the least when people say, how do you do it? But I believe that people are asking a different question than they're aware of. I mean, what people think they're asking, and it's reasonable, is how, you know, what technique did you use to make that card come to the top of the deck or make that coin travel from one hand to another? But I don't think it's because they really want to know any technical details so much as they just want they want an explanation for why something felt so magical to them or so exciting or so unbelievable. And it's really, you know, you wouldn't after a concert go up and ask to see the musician's sheet music as a way of explaining why the music moved you so much. But in magic, it's more reasonable just to think that the explanation of the technical part would satisfy something. But I'm around to kind of hip people, to educate people to the awareness that it's all about the experience. I mean, everything that I'm doing and everything that we're experiencing together is why it felt freaky to you, not because of the specific thing that, I mean, I could take somebody aside and spend an hour and show them a move or two, but that wouldn't really satisfy that.
It seems to me, though, that magic is a categorically different experience than any other theatrical one or even in music. In most cases, we're experiencing emotions that we're familiar with and in many cases want to get to. Now, it can offer an insight. You know, we can go to a place we hadn't been before, but generally speaking, you're taken back to a place where you've been emotionally. What magic seems to do is bring you to this crevice, this crack in the earth where nothing that you knew matters anymore. Physics has been upended, and I'm in this liminal state where I'm forced to ask myself, you know, challenge everything.
Right. Yes and no. I mean, that's absolutely true. But I think then where we go after we are taken to that, you know, edge of the abyss is back to a place of wonder or amazement or not feeling so certain about what our reality is, which is how we've all had those experiences, and most of them happen when we're children, or on psychedelic drugs. But my point is, I think that we get taken. Magic will take us to a place we've never been before. But what that creates in us is this feeling of wonder, or just of a mystery. I mean, I think life is mysterious. Truly, I do, and that's one of the things, reasons I'm motivated to do magic, is that even if I didn't do even if the art of illusion magic didn't exist, I would still believe that life is mysterious. So I think that magic can help remind us or create that belief in us, you know, the same as something else that happens mysterious.
Well, you know, we've talked about the experience that you've had going around, especially meeting up with skeptics. And when you do close-up magic, you're right there table to table. Have you ever had the feeling that you've made a convert, that there is somebody who is just dead set against you and now their mouth is agape?
Often.
Yeah.
Often I'll have people, I mean, I really don't mind. I mean, almost to the point of enjoying when people say, I don't really like magic. You know, I mean, it's a balance. If I'm approaching people at a party, I'm not really there to kind of push somebody's, you know, I'm there here to have a good time. So I got to find a balance between respecting their feelings. And not, I mean, very few people are completely resistant. Like, I don't want to see it. But, you know, some people say, I can tell in people's eyes when they feel like in their mind they're being polite. Like, oh, yeah, I guess you could show me a couple things. And I, you know, that's their way of saying they don't particularly, magic doesn't appeal to them. And it happens all the time that afterwards they say, oh my gosh, that's not what I thought you were going to do. I thought you were going to do, I know, something ridiculous. Or I saw this magician one time and I didn't, you know, that's how I thought you were going to make me feel. And this is fantastic. And that's quite frequent for me.
That's kind of interesting. But there is this other aspect of your job. When you do close-up magic, it means constantly approaching strangers. Does that get over that? Is it uncomfortable?
It's a little bit, you know, in every event that I do is different. You know, half the events that I do, people know there's a magician there. And so when I walk up, they say, oh yeah, I heard that you were going to be here. Yeah, show me something. And that's obviously great. And when people have no idea I'm going to be there, it can be fun. I mean, it can be a little bit, you know, I can play with that a little bit and kind of spend 20 seconds talking to them before they realize that I'm a hired entertainer and that I'm doing magic for them. And that's fun. So, you know, that's, it varies from event to event, but it's, you know, sometimes it, you know, it'll take a little bit of a moment, and I just have to have a really good skill also. I mean, there are times when it's not appropriate to interrupt a conversation or to, you know, and I do magic at Mellow Mushroom Restaurant here. Most at this point, I mean, I've been doing it for years and most people know that I'm there. So when I walk up, it's not, you know, they don't look at me like they have no idea what I'm approaching them for, but it still happens, you know, people, and I have to explain, I'm not, you know, some crazy guy off the street. I'm
not going to take your wallet.
Right, exactly.
You know, we made this joke about doing magic on the radio. I changed the Bavarian Symphony into a 1991 Vespa, which, by the way, if you were watching carefully, you would have known that was an 85 Vespa. And we didn't even get a single phone call.
No.
So nobody apparently rides Vespas. So obviously the joke is you can't see it. How do you get away? But it seems to me the same problem with television. I mean, why should I, could I possibly believe, or why shouldn't I believe that you stopped the camera? And why would anybody be fooled by that?
Yeah, well, you have to take the magician's word at it, and some people do and some people don't. It's certainly the reason why any close-up magician like myself, or, you know, and any other has had the experience of people saying, oh my God, this is the best I've ever, this is so much better than when you see it on TV or even on a big stage. And they don't really mean, I mean, I don't feel like I'm you know, you can't really compare my magic to some big stage magician. I don't feel like they're telling me I'm better. What they're telling me is that this stuff that happened right in their hands was the most magical feeling to them. And that's absolutely true between that and television. And that's why, you know, we hear that all the time. But I will say that, again, getting back to David Blaine, one of his, he created a television show where everybody watching felt like if they were there, they would have had the same experience because they were playing off of the experience that the spectators on the television were having. And that's what a stage magician has to do too. You have to get somebody up on the stage and then the audience will, they'll be the representative for the audience. And if that person is having a magical experience, then they feel like, okay, well, then this is magical.
So that's the big part. That's the big role that the assistant plays.
Yep.
You have performed in Japan, and I'm wondering if the language barrier is a problem. Does that make things easier?
Neither. I mean, it was a challenge. It was different than, you know, everything I do is different. So that was a different experience because I couldn't realize. But I had to spend some time ahead of time planning, making sure I, you know, I mean, it, I could say, well, magic crosses language barriers. You don't need to speak. But the truth is that I've developed a routine that's quite dependent on me talking about things or making a joke or asking somebody to picture something or, you know, verbally connecting with somebody because I am able to most of the time. So when I went there, I had to kind of walk my talk and really make sure I believed that magic crosses language barriers and should be able to be entertaining and magical without verbal communication, and that's what I had to
so
do.
So you didn't work through an interpreter or anything?
I did for a little bit of the time, but I wanted to make sure that I had enough material, enough magic that I wouldn't be dependent on one.
How important is the narrative? You're trying to create, again, this magic is happening in my mind, so where you take me is important, so therefore the narrative could be very important.
I think it is. I mean, it's both are true at the same time. I would love, you know, I love that language, that magic crosses language barriers and really is one of the few art forms that you can really share with just about anybody anywhere. But I really also am very, very deliberate about what I say, you know, I mean, while I'm doing the magic. And a lot of the things that come across as impromptu are a balance between really being spontaneous in the moment and really having thought quite a bit about what's the, I mean, once I have something technical, okay, I can make a card, go in the middle of the deck and come to the top. And you can either do that like, oh, that's a clever little cute thing, or you can do it in a way that that feels magical to people. And most of the difference between that is in how you present it. And a lot of the presentation is in what I say. So I spend quite a bit of time coming up with how I'm going to share a piece of magic.
How did you learn this?
I had a teacher in California that I studied with for very short spurts of time. I mean, I had already moved back to North Carolina by the time I picked up magic. And he actually lived very close to where I used to live in L.A., but I never got into magic. He was an old family friend, though. That's how we knew each other. And when I got bitten by the magic bug, I contacted him pretty early on in the process and asked for permission to come and study with him a little bit. And he was kind of convinced at my sincerity. And so I spend time with him occasionally, and that just kind of got the ball rolling.
Is that how most magicians learn magic, through a mentor, kind of an apprenticeship?
I think so. I don't really spend.
Is there a magic college?
There's some classes. There's magicians who kind of run camps. Most of those are geared towards younger people, but not all. And I was, you know, I mean, another thing about my study of magic is that most guys my age who are professionals, or most people who are professional magicians, really started much earlier on, started as little kids, you know, and so they have, you know, if they're in their 30s, they have 20 years of magic behind them. And I didn't pick it up until I was well into my adulthood. So I've had to kind of make up for that by just working like crazy at it. But I studied with him, and then he kind of got the ball rolling, gave me some books to read and other people to meet and you know, places to go to try to learn and share and develop on stuff on my own.
There is technique. Did you have to practice a lot? Do you still practice regularly?
All the time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I don't know if you play an instrument, but would it be like learning an instrument?
It is, yeah.
Musical instrument,
yep.
So you have to stay with it?
It's quite a bit like that because the, you know, the technique, especially the basic parts of the technique, are quite a bit like your scales. You know, you're never going to necessarily be playing those scales in a concert, but you can't ever get to the point where you're performing in a concert unless you play those scales over and over and over. So, yeah, magic is like that.
Can anybody do it?
I think so.
Really?
I think different people have different personalities in terms of the interpersonal part of it, the connecting.
Yeah.
In terms of the technical part, I think that anyone who has enough kind of, you know, enough discipline and enough passion for it, just like any other art form, can learn the technical part. And then you just have to be honest with yourself about your presentational style. I mean, some people, it depends on what you mean by it. I guess that's a better answer. Some people are never going to be kind of a dark, brooding, intense, you know, making people feel like really reading their mind kind of guy, because they're lighthearted, or they're kind of jokey, or their personality, or the way they look, or whatever. And so they have to be honest about that and develop a persona as a magician that fits them, and vice versa. You know, people who are just a little bit too intense are probably not going to do very well getting up and, you know, making a whole bunch of little kids laugh at a birthday party. They're going to frighten them. So I'm somewhere in between.
You talked about reading your mind. I know you've performed a series of sold-out shows at Man Bites Dog in Durham. And during that show, you used a volunteer to do a trick that resembles ESP. Tell us about that trick.
Yeah, well, the whole second act of the show, I mean, this, first of all, I'll say that the show was the first time I'd ever done anything really formally on a stage in that kind of setting. And as soon as the folks from Man Bites Dog kind of approached me and we talked about it a few years before it happened, I really realized that I did not want to make it something that felt like you could have just hired it for a party, or, you know, I saw this, you know, 10 years ago at my friend's birthday party or something. I really wanted to make it a theater piece. So you know, I spent a long time trying to develop a theater piece themed with magic rather than a magic show where it's one trick after another. So the second act of the show really started to look, explore the aspects of magic that are most alive and fresh for me right now, which is this idea of reading people. And I'm not denying, I mean, I wouldn't claim that it doesn't use any of the techniques that I had learned as a magician, but it's much less dependent on tricks or sleight of hand or whatever. And most of it, or quite a bit of it, is just about what I'm claiming in terms of really trying to get an intuitive connection between people and guide them towards, you know, towards what I'm asking them to think about or whatever. I don't ever claim that I have ESP or psychic power because I don't even really quite know what that is, and who knows if anybody has it. But I really am trying to, have people think of things and then create the experience that I've really come up with what they've thought of, and or come up with something in the moment, or guide them towards, you know, subtle cues. That's another really fun thing to do, you know, subliminal things, and, you know, like do little flashes and say, now come up with something. And then I show them afterwards. It's part of the reason you did that is because I kind of cued you to it.
So you're pushing someone to a certain extent in a certain direction, maybe blocking off certain areas of thought, getting them into one area.
Or trying, you know, I mean, it still ends up with a free choice or a free thought process. But I think it's really fascinating to, I mean, it's really engaged. People seem very fascinated by the possibility of reading people, both the guiding of people and the picking up on cues from people.
You seem to have thought very deeply about this. Are there people who write about this in a serious way? Have you read any scholarly research?
Yeah, there's great theory books on magic. I mean, many of the really great magicians have whole, you know, big 400-page books that have no tricks in them that are just about the theory of magic.
Wow.
One of my favorite performers is named Darren Brown, and he's real well known in England. He has television shows, and I think we'll probably see him around here sometime in the next year or two as well. But he's written two books that are just about the theory of magic, and several other people have.
How about
as well.
The psychology of it? I mean, I'm wondering if people have looked at not necessarily magicians, psychologists, and others in the research world who say, well, let's take a look at how this works on the mind to see how the mind works.
I think there's a big overlap. I don't know if it started with magic or you know, bled over into magic, but there's a huge overlap between psychology and magic. And I've read several books that have nothing to do with magic about reading people and understanding psychology that really is very really helpful for me making those connections in a magical context.
I think connecting with people, learning how to listen to them and figure out what's going on with them is a kind of magic we should all learn.
That's what it's all about.
That was actor and magician Josh Lozov. One of the many conversations that stand out in my memory over the years as host of The State of Things. Thank you for listening. You can catch more of these conversations from The State of Things every Tuesday and Thursday at noon through the end of the year. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.